Huey timed it carefully for the last hour before dark, for the last of the day when the shadows were long and the light uncertain. During the afternoon he skirmished at the ford in half-cohort strength, but in the thick forest on the banks of the stream he held his main strength in reserve. He let them rest during the heat of the afternoon, let them eat and drink, and sharpen their blades while he made his preparations. He chose 50 of his finest, selecting them by name from the ranks, and he took them well back where they would be screened from prying eyes on the heights beyond the stream. From the bottoms of the cooking pots, they scraped the thick black soot and mixed it into a thick paste with cooking oil. This was not enough to darken the skins of 50 men, so for their arms and legs they used the black mud from the river. They were all of them stripped stark naked when the slave chains were shackled about their throats, but instead of the iron pins, a thin, dry twig was used to close the links on every collar. They couldn't take shields with them, and they smeared their weapons with a thick coating of black mud to hide the twinkle and flash of naked metal, and then they strapped them to their backs so that they could run empty-handed. "Your slaves," Huey told them, "not legionaries. Run like a slave. Scamper. Scamper like a beaten dog." When they broke from the trees and ran for the river with half a century of legionaries in pursuit, they howled with terror, and the carefully aimed arrows pattered around them. They reached the bank 500 paces upstream from the ford. As they blundered across, still linked together by the slave chain, the Vendi King from his vantage point saw their escape and sent two large parties of archers and spearmen to screen their crossing. A fierce, bloody little battle flared up on the river bank, and under cover of the tumult, Huey got his group over the river and into the shelter of the forest on the far bank. There was a thin detachment of tribesmen in set positions amongst the trees, but by the time they realized the deception, Huey's band had dropped their chains and cut them in a silent, murderous rush. Then they were through, with nothing opposing them to the foot of the command hill. Bunched up and hidden by the forest, Huey led them at a run around the back of the hill. They'd moved fast, and he rested them here for a few minutes. The mud had washed from legs and arms during the crossing of the river, and the soot and oil was streaky with sweat, giving them a wild and desperate appearance. The clamour of the fighting at the river had died away, and the forest was silent and still as Huey led his band up the back slope of the hill. There were sentries posted here, but they were inattentive and didn't see the weird blackened figures amongst the forest shades until it was too late. Below the bare dome of granite, Huey waited, listening for the diversion which Lannan had promised. The distant yells and tiny scraping sound of metal from the ford were almost blanketed by the distance and the intervening bulk of the hill. Huey said softly, "Now, all together." And they burst from the forest edge and went racing away up the granite dome. Huey led them easily, bounding ahead with the loping, long-armed gait of an old bull baboon. When he was 20 paces from the crest, the Vendi King sensed his presence and turned to face Huey. He shouted a warning to his staff, and Huey went at him like a terrier at the throat of a lion. Two of the king's bodyguard leapt to intervene, but Huey flicked a casual axe stroke at them, rolling his wrist slightly in mid-stroke, so the blade whimpered as it changed direction, killing one guard cleanly and taking the spear arm of the other away above the elbow with a single cut. They fell aside, and Huey went on to take the king. He was a big man, perhaps the biggest Huey had ever met, and his skin was a shiny purplish black. The muscles of shoulder and arms were bunched and knotted. The sinews of his neck stood out starkly, corded with the heavy bone of his jaw. His head was round as a river-washed boulder, and without headdress, the scalp was bald and polished black. He moved to meet Hui, sliding in on thick black legs, with his leopard-skin kilt swirling, crouching slightly with the stabbing spear held underhand, the blade glistening hungrily for the softness of Hui's belly. He moved with leopard speed, reacting instantly to Hui's attack, and there was a sense of savage power and energy about him that checked Hui's charge and made him whirl instinctively to the side just as the blade of the stabbing spear slashed upwards through nothingness where Hui's belly should have been. The huge black man grunted as his stroke died in air, and his tawny yellow eyes fastened on Hui. He struck again, and Hui hopped aside as the point hissed past him. And Hui reached out as he sprang and ran the stabbing point of the axe across the giant's exposed ribs. The purple-black skin opened, and for an instant white bone showed in the depth of the wound before the rush of dark blood obscured it. The king bellowed at the sting of it, and he struck and slashed and cut at the dancing gadfly before him. Each stroke wilder, each charge more reckless, as Hui goaded him, watching for his moment. It came, and suddenly Hui was through the circle of the spear. With the point of the axe he probed for the femoral artery in the giant's groin, running the engraved steel into the tight flesh half an inch too far to the right, missing the artery, but dropping the king to one knee. Hui twisted out of close contact. The axe flew high, and Hui went into the kill stroke, aiming at the round black skull of the kneeling king, a stroke which would split him to the chest. "For Baal!" he shouted, sending the axe down from on high. And then, in full stroke, he changed. He never knew what impulse it was that made him check, made him twist the weapon, presenting the flat of the blade and not the edge, holding the stroke half back, so that the side of the axe cracked against the king's skull with enough force to topple him forward senseless onto his face, but not enough to stove in the bone of the great round head. Hui jumped back and, with one quick glance, made certain that the bended king's train were all lying lifeless on the dome of granite, and his legionaries were grouped around him resting on their bloodied sword. The surprise had been complete and overwhelming. Hui turned and ran to the highest point of the hill. Naked, filthy with soot and mud, he brandished his axe above his head, and his band cheered and waved their weapons also. From the ford a trumpet began to blare the advance, and immediately the call was taken up and shrilled from cohort to cohort. Hui watched Lannan lead the first wave across the ford. The legion crashed into the leaderless tribesmen who opposed them, and drove them with scarcely a check, splitting them and driving them back against the hills in a disorganized rabble. They had seen their king cut down, and there was no spirit left in any of them. From the hilltop, Hui watched Lannan commit his last two reserve cohorts at exactly the right moment. The tribesmen broke and made a rout of it. Throwing aside their weapons, they streamed back in a wailing, panic-stricken mob into the bottleneck between the hills. At that moment, the handsome young Backmore, with the two cohorts which had driven the captured cattle to the great river, marched out of the forest. He deployed the cohorts neatly across the only line of retreat open to the tribes. His return was timely indeed, and Hui watched him with grudging professional approval as he made his dispositions. As the sun touched the horizon in a splendor of red and purple, the trumpet sounded the advance once again, and the slaughter and the slave-taking lasted until after midnight. Hui crossed his legion and the host of wild slaves using the elephant-drawn rafts at Set. After the battle at the ford, the return march had been unopposed. The regiments of the Vendi had been shattered, all their war chiefs killed or captured, and Lannan was jubilant. He told Hui My sunbird, it was more than I asked of you. Even I did not guess that such a dangerous enemy had grown up upon my borders. If we'd left him another year, only the gods know how deadly he might have become. Bale smiled upon me, who he disclaimed modestly. And so does Lannan Hyckenus, Lannan assured him. What was the harvest, sunbird? Has old Rib Adai made the accounting yet? I hope so, my lord. Send for him, Lannan commanded. And Rib Adai came in with his scrolls and his ink-stained fingers and his untrusting little bookkeeper's eyes. He read out the lists of cattle and slaves of each grade, every one of them carefully categorized by the slave masters. The prices will be much depressed, sir, Rib Adai pointed out pessimistically, for the other legions have taken a great tribute from all the tribes across the river. It will be 2 or 3 years before the markets of Opit have absorbed this massive wealth. Nevertheless, the prize money taken by the 6th Ben Ammon must be considerable, Rib Adai. As my lord says. How much? Lannan demanded. Rib Adai looked alarmed. Well, I could only hazard a guess, Majesty. Well, guess then, Lannan invited him. It could be as much as 25,000 fingers, and as low as... Oh, you'd smell dung in an alabaster jar of perfume, Lannan chided the old man. Don't give me your low figure. As my lord pleases, Rib Adai bowed, and Lannan turned to Hui and clapped his shoulder. Your share is 1 part in 100, sunbird. 250 fingers, huh? You're a rich man at last. How does it feel? It does not sicken me, Hui grinned at him, and Lannan laughed delightedly as he turned back to Rib Adai. Write in your book, old man, write that Lannan Hyckenus sets aside half of his share of the prize. He makes it over as an award to the legion commander, Hui Ben Ammon, for his conduct of the campaign. My lord, that's 1 part in 20, Rib Adai protested vehemently. It is an award of over 1,000 fingers. I have learnt my figures also, Lannan assured him, and the bookkeeper might have protested further, but he saw Lannan's expression. It shall be written, it shall be written, he mumbled, and Hui came to kneel before his king in gratitude. Up, up, Lannan ordered him, smiling. Don't grovel for me, old friend. And Hui went to stand beside Lannan's stool as the king called each of the officers who had acted with distinction and made the awards. Hui was lost in a trance of avarice, hardly able to credit his fortune. He was rich. Rich! He must sacrifice to the gods this very day, a white bull at the least. As Rib Adai had pointed out, the market was flooded, and Hugh would be able to get one cheaply. And then he remembered that he need no longer stint. He could afford any luxury he had ever coveted, and still have enough over for an estate on the terraces of Zeng, a share in one of Habakkuk Lal's trading galleys, a seat on one of the gold-mining syndicates, a secure income for life. No more patches in his tunics, no more bullying his household to cut down on the consumption of meat, and no more of the cheap, sour wines from the harbour taverns. And then his mind jumped. No more reliance on Lannan's hospitality and on the goodwill of his young slave girls. He would have one of his own. Oh, no, damn it, 2, 3. Young, pretty, and pliant. He felt his body stir. He could afford a wife now. Even the daughters of the noble houses might turn a blind eye to his back when dazzled by such a pile of the gold metal. And then suddenly he remembered Tanith, and the phantom slave girls and wives faded back into the mists of his imagining. His spirits plunged sickeningly. The priestesses of Astarte were dedicated to the goddess. They could never marry. Suddenly Hui did not feel as rich as he had a moment before. "Do you not hear your king when he speaks?" Lannan demanded. And Hui started guiltily. "My lord, forgive me, I was dreaming." "It is no longer necessary to dream," Lannan told him. "What was it that the Grey Lion asked?" "I said we should send for the barbarian. We can deal with him before the legion assembles." Hui looked around at his cohorts, drawn up in an open square before the leather awning under which Lan sat. The legion standards glittered in the sunlight, and the officers stood at ease before their men. They waited expectantly, and Hui sighed quietly. "As the Grey Lion wishes." "Order it so," Lannan commanded. They had chained him at wrists and ankles, as well as at the throat. The slave masters could pick a dangerous one at a glance, and two of them held him in leash by the chains from his throat collar. He was big, as Hui remembered, and his skin even darker, but he was a young man. This came as a shock to Hui. He had thought of him as being in his prime years, but this was an illusion. The man's physical bulk and his commanding presence made him older than his years. Hui saw how he had fought against his bonds, tearing his own flesh, smearing the skin on the unyielding iron shackles, and the wound in his groin had been crudely dressed with leaves and bark. There were the first watery, yellow discharges of putrefaction soiling the dressing, and the flesh around it looked hard and swollen. Although he limped, although the chains jangled mockingly at every pace, and although the slave masters braced against him as though he were a captured animal, there was no mistaking that he was a king. He stood before Lannan and lowered his head slightly on the thick, sinewed neck. His eyes were ferocious. Even the whites were yellow, smoking, and covered with a fine lacework of blood vessels, and he stared at his captors with a hatred that was a palpable thing. "You captured this great black beast, Hui?" Lannan returned the giant's stare. "Without help you took him?" Lannan shook his head with wonder and turned to Hui, but Hui was watching the Vendi king. "What is your name?" Hui asked softly. And the big round head swiveled towards him. The fierce eyes held his.
"How do you have the tongue of Vendi?"
"I have many tongues," Hui assured him. "Who are you?"
"Manatasi, king of the Vendi."
And Hui translated for Lannan.
"Tell him he's no longer king," Lannan snapped.
And Manatasi shrugged and smiled. His smile was a frightening thing, for although the thick purple lips drew back to expose strong white teeth, yet his eyes still smoked with hatred.
50,000 warriors of Vendi call me king still," he answered.
"A slave king of a slave people," Lannan laughed, and then to Hui. "What of him, Hui? Is he not a dangerous enemy? Can we afford to let him live?" Hui tore his gaze from the slave king and considered the question, trying to think logically, but finding it difficult. Hui had conceived a sudden but powerful proprietary interest in Manatasi. He was impressed with the man's power and presence, with the military skills he displayed, with the cunning, cleverness, and that strange, smouldering depth of him. Hui had taken him. He could claim him, even from Lannan, and he was strongly tempted to do so now, for he sensed that here was some extraordinary opportunity. To take this man and educate him, civilize him, what might not be made of him? He felt an excitement as a new idea tried to struggle to the surface of his mind. I think not, Lannan answered himself. From the first moment I saw him on the hill above the ford, I knew he was dangerous, deadly dangerous. I do not think we can let him live. Hui. He would make a fine messenger to the gods. We will dedicate him to Baal, and send him as a messenger to express our gratitude for the outcome of the campaign. My lord, Hui dropped his voice for Lannan alone. I have a feeling about this man. I feel I could enlighten him, teach him the true gods. He is young, my lord. I could work upon him. And, when we are ready, we could return him to his people. Have the birds picked out your brain? Lannan looked at Hui in astonishment. Why should we return him to his people when we've spent so much effort on capturing him? We could use him as an ally then. Hui was trying desperately to get his idea over. Through him, we could make a treaty with the tribes. We could win him over and use him to secure our northern borders. Treaties. Treaties with barbarians? Lannan was angry now. What nonsense is this? Secure our northern borders, you say? One thing and one thing only will secure our northern borders, and that's a sharp sword in a strong hand. My lord, please hear me out. No, Hui. I'll have no more of it. He must die, and quickly. Tonight at sunset. Lannan stood up. Prepare to send him. And Lannan strode away. Dismiss the legion, Hui ordered his commanders, and nodded to the slave masters to lead the captive away. But Manatasi stepped forward, dragging the slave masters with him on the chains. Highborn, Manatasi called Hui, who turned back to him with surprise. He had not expected a title of respect. What is it? Hui looked at him.
Is it death?
Manatasi asked, and Hui nodded. It is death, he admitted.
But you argued for me,
Manatasi insisted, and again Hui nodded.
Why?
Demanded the slave king, and Hui couldn't answer. He spread his hands, a gesture of weariness and incomprehension.
Twice already, the slave king said. First you turned the blade, which should have killed, and now you speak for me. Why?
I don't know. I cannot explain.
You feel the bond. The bond between us,
Manatasi declared, and his voice sank low, rumbling and soft.
The bond of the spirits. You felt it.
No, no. Hui shook his head and hurried away to his tent. He worked on his scrolls for most of the afternoon, recording the campaign, describing the burning and the battle at the ford, listing the battle honors and the slaves taken, the booty and the glory. But he could not bring himself to describe Manatasi. The man would soon be dead. Let his memory die with him. Let it not linger on to haunt the living. A phrase that Lannan used stuck in his mind. The black beast. And he used it as the only reference to the doomed slave king.